on higher education, finance, and policy will come to order. A quorum is not present. Before we proceed with our first order of business for today, I would like to recognize the presence of some special visitors here today. We have a group of ninth grade students from the Lakes International Language Academy in Forest Lake joining us. Welcome, students. Thank you for being here. We hope to put on our best demonstration of democracy in action for you. Our first order of business is House File 1912. Representative Hansen, would you please make your way to the testifier table? Representative Hansen is not here. Duly noted, Representative Davids. We will now proceed to House File 2253. Representative Novotny, thank you for being here. Would you please make your way to the testifiers table? House File 2253 is within the possession of this committee, and it will remain in the possession of this committee for future consideration of inclusion in the Higher Education Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Representative Votney, would you please explain House File 2253?
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. The 2253 is a request for $2.5 million that will be used for in-service multi-jurisdictional dynamic law enforcement training. This bill has been in the works for almost 2 years. It's a response to the need of the duty to intercede that came out of discussions in the summer of 2020. And the situation that we are trying to solve is this. The duty to intercede is something an officer might deal with in the first week of work, or they might have a situation that they might not have to deal with for 20 years. But when that duty to intercede is necessary, they need to have experience in that and know what their responsibilities are. And the first time they have to make that decision, if they should intercede, shouldn't be on the street in a real life scenario. Part of the problems that we discuss is most use of force training is done interagency. State Patrol works with State Patrol, DNR does use of force training with the DNR, and so on. In reality, at the end of a chase, three counties from where it started, you could be in a situation where you're dealing with someone that you've never worked with, and they just happen to be who shows up at the scene. It could be an officer that's fairly new from a small department dealing with a senior officer from a state agency who is maybe been injured in a crash or something and may be losing their temper or whatever the situation is that they need to be interrupted and redirected. The only way we're going to do that is if we practice doing that. If approved, Bill 2253 would have programs like Alexandria Vocational Technical Institute or Hennepin Tech that has the facilities to do the dynamic simulation and bring in multiple departments, and you will work together with people that you don't normally work with and have that training, have multiple scenarios that you run through, change them up, have them evaluated, go back, do it again. In response to a request from then Public Safety Chair Mariani, in talking about how we could also use that training to have training on bias motivation and de-escalation, that we included that language in the bill, and I think that's a perfect situation. We're going to have multiple runs through. If they're doing it right, and I believe they will be, your adrenaline will be pumping. This is the perfect situation where you should practice that de-escalation techniques. Further, is it that this is a situation that can lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. And when we're having that discussion, we're in the environment where you're doing these high-stress incidents, have a good chance to talk with the people there and how they deal with it, how they go home, how they unpack this and deal with it in a healthy way as opposed to a potentially destructive way of dealing with their PTSD. And we also had the advantage of doing that outside of your normal training, your normal people that you work with every day, your off-site, and we have people that can discuss that PTSD in maybe a non-judgmental way because you are away. The funding, we thought, if the state funds this, then we don't have the problems with getting approval from the smaller departments or the timing. My experience for better part of 15 years, I was responsible for scheduling out of area training for people. To get an approval from the county board, it's a lot of work. It's subject to a lot of oversight. And I'll give you an example. I went to a use of force training once in Hutchinson. From my house, it was almost a two-hour drive. My sheriff, instead of going through the paperwork and going through the board approval process, told me to put in for overtime for two-hour drive down, two-hour drive back at the end of the day, because it was easier than getting approval for an overnight stay and the per diem on the rest for meals. This would take care of all that. We figured 90% of the law enforcement officers in the state are within a one-hour drive of one of these schools like Alex Tech or Hennepin Tech or Hibbing. We can cover a large amount of the state, and the ones that aren't close enough, the schools would travel to and take their equipment to one of the, say for example, Marshall College, they could do the training there. And with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Otney. There are no amendments for House File 2253. Before we proceed to member discussion, are there any members of the public who wish to offer testimony to House File 2253? Seeing none, we will proceed to member discussion. Are there any members who would like to discuss House File 2253? Representative Cleborn.
Chair Wilgamon, I apologize. I was meeting with constituents, so I was a little late getting to committee. What is the motion before us at this time? Are we laying this over, or are we moving it out of committee?
House File 2253 is in the possession of this committee, and it will remain in the possession of this committee for future consideration in our Higher Education Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill.
Thank
Representative
you.
Cleborn.
Thank you very much, Chair Wilgamon. And Representative Novotny, I think simulator training is really important. I know that in the northwestern suburbs, we have recently built a new simulator to be used by that northwest region of the metro area to help our officers do the training that you're discussing. So I do really appreciate you bringing this bill forward and understand the importance of this training. Thank you.
Representative Botany, would you care to respond?
I agree. It is a good program, and they would be able to apply and sponsor a class, and they would open it up to multiple jurisdictions to send people to this training. They've got the state-level instructors. They've got the equipment. They've got the simunitions that make it real enough to really get the lifelike characters of the training that they need. So thank you.
Further discussion, House File 2253. I recognize Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny, for bringing this bill. I do think it's important. Just prior to committee, I was on the phone with a constituent who has been dealing with some of this training issues and the access to training and making it more practicable for small forces in particular, so that they can access the training without having their law enforcement officers gone for multiple days or additional extreme expense, is really helpful, especially with scheduling challenges. So this is a great idea. I hope we support it as a committee. Thank you.
Representative Novotny, would you care to respond?
Thank you, Chair Wilkman. Yeah, and that is also a great point, Representative Robbins. The different agencies have different capabilities, and as you said, some of the smaller agencies do not have access to the sim munitions that, say, for example, the State Patrol has at Ripley. So this would get everybody on the same page. This is not designed to replace any use of force training. It is more like a final test.
Any further discussion to House File 2253? Seeing none, Representative Novotny, closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. I believe this bill will make a difference, and it'll make a difference in the way that no one will notice, because hopefully we will avoid situations that will bring attention. It's the tree that falls in the woods that you don't hear, and that's what we're looking for, and we hope to avoid situations that cause people to be under PTSD and have bad reactions. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Novotny, thank you for bringing House File 2253 before our committee. We will continue to maintain possession of House File 2253, and we will consider it for inclusion in our higher education finance and policy omnibus bill. And with that, members, I will hand the gavel back to Chair Pawlowski.
Next on the agenda is the presentation from the University of Minnesota. All right, there's a letter in your packet, members. I would suggest you take the letter out before we start the presentation. Budget Director Thomas, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Yes, for the record, my name is Julie Tonneson. I am the Budget Director for the University of Minnesota. And this morning, I am here to provide just some summary statements about the responses that we've submitted and that the Chair just referenced in the letter we submitted to the committee for the questions that were raised last Tuesday during our testimony related to our amended budget request. Two of the questions were actually pretty straightforward, so I won't take your time now this morning to go into detail on those responses in my summary. Hopefully they are clear in the letter. That's for both the question about the core mission request item as a percent of our appropriation base in the biennium, and then the question about how much in additional O&M funding would the university need to implement a resident undergraduate tuition rate freeze for the next 2 years. I do want to highlight briefly some points related to the other two questions answered in the response, however. The first had to do with what can be kind of a complex process to explain related to our tuition revenue estimating each year. It's actually a cyclical process, so it's hard to know the best place to kind of step into the circle and help explain it and make it understandable, but I think I'll step in at the point where we are setting the annual budget. To produce the tuition revenue estimate for the budget approved by the board every June, we develop that estimate based on the most recent forecast of the year we are just ending, a forecast that is updated in the January-February timeframe and then is refined through May. And that forecast of the year we are ending is combined then with projections for the upcoming year in changes in student numbers, credit loads, resident, non-resident mix, and so forth. Not just for the entering class, but for all student levels. So in the year of preparing a biennial request then, in the even numbered calendar year, we're preparing this estimate for the next 2 years, 12 months before those years start. So the biennial request we submitted to the state in October that you subsequently received was based on needs and priorities for FY 24 and 25, built off of planning assumptions and expenditure and revenue projections that started with that FY 23 approved budget tuition revenue estimate. Then as part of our normal cycle, we reforecast the current year after the start of spring term, just as the state completes a revenue forecast in February of each year. And this year, our forecast showed a $24 million shortfall for FY 23 which is, again, our base year for projecting the next biennium's costs and revenues. As we mentioned at the hearing last week and laid out in the letter, our standard estimating processes have produced actually very sound results in past years. The pandemic threw a wrench in many of our operations in FY21 in particular, which we were somewhat prepared for, but we did not anticipate the magnitude of the ongoing impact of the pandemic on student behavior and thus enrollments moving into FY23. I won't repeat here today all of the pandemic impacts we've been learning about and discussing, but I do want to stress that the freshman enrollment on the Twin Cities campus remains very strong. In fact, we've had historically high, large entering classes the last 2 years, and things are looking good for this fall as well. So demand is high. But there have been impacts on continuing student variables for the Twin Cities campus and on all student variables for our other campuses, which we did not get right in our estimates. As the letter points out, our variances between budget and updated forecasts during the year have been less than 1% for 3 of the last 4 years, and just slightly over 1% for the year most impacted by the COVID uncertainties. So the variance this year of 2.4% stands out. In most years, when we had a couple of units with notable negative variances, which we do pretty much every year, we also had other units with positive variances to balance that out. This year, there are more units with notable negative variances without those offsetting positive results in the other units. The letter further provides this year's variance by campus as requested in terms of percent and dollar amounts. And then finally, we responded to the question about potential tuition rate increases if the state funds our core mission request but chooses not to fund the tuition shortfall or the tuition freeze. In that situation, we have to go forward. The university planned to cover its half of the projected $90 million in cost increases each year with internal budget cuts and potentially tuition rate changes. And as we discussed before, we were modeling rate increases of 3.5% on the Twin Cities campus and 1% increases on the other campuses. So the question now was, how would those modeled rates change with adding the new $24 million shortfall in as a cost to be addressed by the university? The new modeling with that assumption would change the rate increases from 3.5% on the Twin Cities campus to the 6.5% to 7.5% range for FY24, and choosing the midpoint of that range, so 7% as an example, would result in a dollar increase of $980 for FY24 on the Twin Cities campus, with the increase for FY25 falling back down to that planned or previously modeled 3.5% or $525. For the system campuses, the new modeling assumption would change the rate increase from 1% to the 3% to 4% range for FY24. And choosing the midpoint of that range as an example, so 3.5%, would result in a dollar increase of $388 to $448 for FY24, depending on the campus, with the increase for FY25 falling back down to 1%, or a range of $115 to $133, depending on campus. Again, I need to emphasize that these are modeling results, as we're just halfway through our budget development process for the first year of the biennium. So they're definitely subject to change based on new cost and revenue information and the priorities and actions of the Board of Regents. I also want to convey that under any scenario, even with full funding by the state of all of the university's requested items, it will be necessary for the university to implement some level of internal budget cuts in order to balance the budget. That remains, under all potential outcomes on the table, part of our plans. And with that, Mr. Chair, I hope that answers the letter and my comments help to answer the questions you put to us last week. But I am happy to help clarify any confusion or attempt to answer additional questions about these materials, and I thank you for your attention.
Budget Director Thompson, I want to thank you for your information. I want to go to the last statement that you said about budget cuts. Mm-hmm. If you recall, the MnState system provided a breakdown by campus, even if they got their full funding request, of what would be cut. We're getting reports now on what's happening on those campuses in the campus-wide meetings. Do you have that type of detail of what would happen campus by campus as far as the cuts would be concerned?
Mr. Chair, I do not have that. Our process is somewhat different than perhaps is done at Minnesota State, but we have a very robust process of meeting with every one of our units, including the system campuses, every year, unit by unit, and going through all of their challenges and opportunities. And we don't make those decisions about how to allocate the final cuts or even what the final cuts will need to be until we go through that process. So it would be later this spring in which we would be making those decisions for FY24.
Budget Director Tonneson, would we still be in session by the time you make that decision?
Mr. Chair, probably we're going to end about the same time with our processes. We have to have our materials done for the Board of Regents meeting in June. We have to have that done in mid-May.
Budget Director Tonneson, I'm going to request that when you get that information, whether we're in session or not, that it be delivered to this committee.
Sure.
Because we would like to see what would happen or what is going to happen.
Be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. It's part of the budget document we present to the board each year, so correct. We would have that.
Discussion from members. Seeing no discussion, Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the budget director. I'm looking at page 5 of the note, so trying to compare the different types of funding level from fully funded core mission to fully funded tuition freeze. I see the gaps shift from 7.5 to 0%. When we're looking at 135 million, so the Twin Cities will see up to 7.5. And if we fully fund the tuition freeze and everything else, it goes to zero with a slight kind of difference. How do you explain that big shift from 7.5 to zero when the numbers have not significantly shifted from 135 million to 223.5 million?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, it is, I'm not sure that the proportions perhaps don't appear to make sense, but when we look through our plans with the 135 million, we were planning, because that only covers about half of our projected cost increases for each year, we were planning the 3.5%. Then if you add in the 24 million, shifting that onto tuition, that's what jumps it up from 3.5 to 6.5 to 7.5% in that example. The tuition freeze then obviously would bring it down to zero because that would be part of the deal. But even that doesn't fund all of our cost increases that we're projecting. So the proportions may not appear correct, but these would be the modeled plans that we could make work under those scenarios.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, just wanted to confirm, if we implement also the zero, you know, cost to Twin Cities and the rest of the campuses, will there be any major deep cuts within the budget framework?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I think that depends on who you're talking to. Our units would say they'd be deep cuts, but from a historical perspective, I don't believe they'd be deep. They would be in the realm of maybe 1%, which is sort of the normal, I think, annual process we would go through, but closer to that rather than deeper cuts.
Representative Scott. I'm sorry, Representative.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have been, or Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking for the documents, and I think I found the right one. But Ms. Tonneson, you said that you didn't anticipate the lower enrollment based on coming out of the pandemic. But actually, according to the documents that we have, the trend has been for the last really kind of 10 years. Overall, that the enrollment has been declining. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to, I guess, I don't know, give you a chance to clarify or just clarify for the record that enrollments were declining prior to the pandemic.
Budget Director.
Yes, Chair Pawlowski, Representative. Yes, and in fact, we did 11 of our 20, went back and looked through all of the notes, 11 of our 20 tuition generating units we have, the system campuses and the colleges. Of the 20, 11 built a reduction in in enrollment into their estimates for FY23. We just didn't go deep enough or broad enough. So it has been happening, and the places it has been happening have been building that in, but it's happened in new ways and deeper than we expected. And again, we built our 23 budget prior to even knowing the numbers that are on your chart for the current year.
So. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess that begs the question of, and maybe we've already covered this and I've just forgotten, but what are, this is really for all universities to consider because it's a national trend, but what are you doing at the University of Minnesota to try to figure out why this is happening? And then are you resolved to like, okay, we don't see this changing anytime soon, so we're going to base our further projections on continued decline? What's kind of the way of thinking there on that?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do, it varies a lot by college and campus in terms of what they're seeing. As I mentioned, on the Twin Cities campus, our undergraduate enrollment is very strong. So we do think a lot of what we're seeing in our colleges on the Twin Cities campus related to that population is an anomaly, and it will turn around. In fact, it has the last 2 years. We're still working on, as I understand it, trying to figure out what's impacting retention and dealing with that, and to understand if there's things we can do to impact that or if it's a cycle. So that population we feel pretty strong about. On our system campuses, they are working very hard to increase enrollment, understand ways that we can do that, trying new things to do that, but at the same time, building budget plans, multi-year budget plans that take into account different enrollment, lower enrollment levels in moving into the future. The other populations at the university are also experiencing change. So our graduate populations, for example, are dropping and have been for years. And there as well, the places that's happening inside the institution, they are making change, which can take years to actually implement, to the lower enrollment levels. So in other words, they would, you know, not need as many faculty perhaps that they change over time, or assistantship funding and so on and so forth. They're changing their budget inside to reflect that reality. Other places are growing, and so it really depends on which unit you're working with and the population you're talking about. The other piece that I will just mention quickly are the transfer students, which have been dropping. And as we've mentioned before, a lot of the feeder into our transfer population comes from the community colleges. And as that has been dropping, so our transfers have been dropping as well. That's another one that we know about, we're planning on, we're dealing with within our annual budget development process with the units.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. So to prepare for today, I went back and I read the territorial charter of the University of Minnesota, which says you're to charge no tuition, which I found to be very interesting considering where we are today. In looking at the documents that you have provided for us in the numerous meetings that you've had with us this year, I still go back to this January 31st presentation that you provided for us. In looking at the pages that have to do with trends in tuition, mm-hmm. excuse me, and in state funding, the fact that you are now so heavily reliant on tuition, right, and the fact that this institution, the legislature, House and Senate, have cut your funding year after year after year, and then I hear you say today, you know, it's a 1% cut. Well, 1% compounded by 1% compounded by 1%. We know the time value of money. Mm-hmm. And these minor cuts become hemorrhaging. And that's what we're seeing today. And I'm very concerned about the students who are in class today paying the costs of these small incremental cuts over time. So I'm not going to beat you up today, but I think we have to have that conversation about how do we get back to the responsibility of the legislature to fund our public institutions to carry out those territorial legislative charter missions. And you have the mission of academic, research, and outreach. These are not necessarily revenue-generating endeavors. So I just want to make sure that we are all talking about shared responsibility in this conversation and not laying it all squarely at your feet. I think you do phenomenal work, and I appreciate the letter that you've provided for us as well today to answer some of these questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Budget Director Tonneson, I want to talk about tuition for a second, too. If we freeze tuition, can you give us what tuition would be for students at the campuses, or would it have to be by program?
Mr. Chair, we have a single undergraduate, resident undergraduate tuition rate on the Twin Cities campus and individual undergraduate rates on each of the system campuses. And those are in the table on page 6 of the letter. If you look at the approved FY 2023 rates.
Okay, thank you. Budget Director Tonneson, thank you for pointing that out. I should have seen it and I didn't, but now we have it. I want to point that out to members that there is still a great burden on students, even if we freeze tuition, that this isn't free. All we're doing is keeping it at this level, and this underscores, I think, Representative Cleavorn's analysis. So if we do freeze it, there's still a burden here, and it's a significant burden that the students will be paying. Further questions from Representative Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this letter. It's very helpful. So I just want to refer to on page 4, and I know you've talked about this a bit, but I wondered if you could kind of help us understand it more clearly by each campus. So it says, quote, due to varied factors discussed at the committee meeting of March 7th, the impacts were more widespread. And this is about the variance in the enrollment rates. And so when you look at the chart on page 3, if you could just go through campus by campus and explain the challenges. Is it transfer students? Is it retaining students? Is it new enrollments? Like, I'd like to get a better sense of what's going on at each campus.
Sure.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say for Crookston, Duluth,
we've got a little movement.
Heard some background noise there. Sorry about that. For Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Rochester, all four of them, Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Rochester, there has been a continued decline in freshmen new entering students. In addition to that, with the pandemic, which also impacted entering students, but we have seen a decrease in retention. So this is continuing students moving from sophomore to junior, for example, or junior to senior. They are leaving. We're seeing more of that. We are seeing more students taking fewer credits. So where they might have taken a full-time credit, 13 to 15 credits, they might be taking 9 or 8 or something like that. That has increased. On those campuses, the transfer numbers aren't as significant, but there has been a decrease in transfers to those campuses as well. And again, it depends a little bit on the campus, but that is happening. And only Duluth and a little bit at Rochester are impacted by the graduate students. So Crookston and Morris do not have graduate students, but Duluth does, and they are also experiencing that reduction in graduate population. The Twin Cities campus is different. It has all of those things except the freshman numbers. So the freshman numbers are actually very strong. Our entering classes, as I mentioned, are the highest we've seen in, you know, pre my time, so over 30 years. They're very strong freshman numbers. But again, the retention has decreased from freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior, and we believe anecdotally, because the students are not required to tell us why they leave, so we don't actually collect that data very well. But anecdotally, what we are hearing, a lot of it has to do with challenges related to the pandemic. Income, could be family income, health issues, childcare comes up, and actually underpreparedness, perhaps, for college coming out of high school has also been more of an issue we've been hearing about.
Representative Robb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But it sounds like you're spreading that across all four campuses pretty evenly. There's not like something more specific to like maybe course offerings at one campus versus another. It sounds like the variances spread pretty evenly.
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, yes, I believe I would say that's true. We're not seeing, there's nothing that stands out as a particular driver unique to a campus.
Representative Robbins.
Forgive me for putting a finer point on it, but Morris is down 19%, mm-hmm. Rochester down 11%, Duluth only 2.9%, mm-hmm. and Crookston at 3.7%. So something must account for that level of variation. What is that?
Budget Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, some of that is size. I mean, we're talking about, when you're talking about small numbers, right, they make a big difference at Crookston and Morris and Rochester in particular. And Rochester, I should say, we're not concerned about Rochester. There's a lot of demand for the programming there. Crookston and Morris, yes, they have been seeing reductions each year, little by little, and small changes in student numbers make a huge difference there. The same changes in student numbers at Duluth, it results in a much smaller percentage. So that's a part of it for sure.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just have one. I'm jumping off of what Representative Robbins just said, and I'm just trying to clarify. So there is a decrease in enrollment for the next, or projected enrollment, in all of the campuses, right? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
But you're not concerned about certain campuses. And I don't understand how these things come together. Can you help me better understand?
Sure.
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when we've been talking about the $24 million, the tuition shortfall, and it's based on an enrollment decrease, that's something we're seeing right now. I'm not prepared to tell you that every college that's seeing an enrollment-related decrease in revenue right now compared to budget will see an enrollment decline in the future. That isn't, they're not the same thing. We are seeing an impact on our tuition revenue this year due to enrollment variables that are producing less tuition. So that could be fewer students, fewer credits. It could be a change in the resident, non-resident mix, for example. There's characteristics about the enrollment that reduced our revenue this year compared to what we thought it would be. Moving forward, most of our program on the Twin Cities campus, we are not anticipating continued reductions in the numbers of students on campus. There still may be shifts on some of those other variables in terms of how many credits they're taking or the resident, non-resident mix, but we're not concerned about an enrollment decrease. Same thing with Rochester. There's a lot of strong interest in the programming there. There has been some retention issues, as there is everywhere across the nation, actually, right now in higher education. We are getting them here. Larger numbers are not staying with it into years 2, 3, and 4, and that's something we're working on. But there's a lot of demand for the programming at Rochester. So when I say we're not concerned, I'm thinking about the long-term outlook for the campus. Crookston and Morris, because of demographics, because of their size, there is concern there, and we're working very hard with the chancellors to try to explain the value proposition for those campuses and increase enrollment, and also plan for a future in which we have different levels of enrollment potential. Duluth also is a very strong campus, and it's a large campus, and so there will be perhaps some changes that need to be made on the campus to adjust to a level of enrollment that's less than it was 10 years ago, but still strong, still a good size campus. Is that helpful?
Kind of. Chair, this may not be the forum for this, so please feel free to tell me so. But I'm trying to figure out how we just say we're not overly concerned, even though there's been this pattern and we're hearing about this global concern, but we're not concerned for the future. But I haven't actually heard any solutions that kind of make me feel like we shouldn't be concerned for the future. kind of baked into that response. And so my kind of gut reaction is, how do we know that? And what are the preventions that we're doing to prevent this continual decline? And how can we be assured that the we're not overly concerned moving forward is accurate? What is the university doing to prevent to change the trajectory, shall we say?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, I will try, although I am not the expert at the university in the question that you are asking, but I will provide an overview and perhaps we can and get you a better answer from an expert other than me. But from my lens, from the budget lens is where I'm approaching this. And we work every year with variances. And it's part of our budget process to project and to plan for some level of variance. As I mentioned, we had 11 out of 20 units built a reduction into their estimates for this year. That will continue to happen. We will continue to work with them to understand what are they seeing, what are they concerned about, push on what are those assumptions, and make budget decisions to address whatever those issues are in the near future. What I am hearing from our folks in admissions is there, as I mentioned, there is strong interest in our programming for the Twin Cities campus, for the health programs in Rochester. So when I say I'm not concerned, obviously every year to year there could be concerns. We may have to deal with ups and downs along the way. But the outlook is good for our programming there. Now, demographics are against all of us, but those programs that are in major metropolitan areas at large Research One institutions are, I think, in a better position, and what I'm hearing in the industry, are in a better position to remain strong. It's the campuses that are outside of metropolitan areas that are most challenged by the demographic changes. And that is where we are working very hard with our chancellors to make real-time budget decisions to build a plan and a financial plan for different levels of enrollment depending on where we end up. So we are actively working on that and trying to view into the future to address those issues now. But some of the things take time, and so we're going to have to, phase in change as necessary.
Representative Hicks, we have the university back on Tuesday. So if you have further questions you want answered, we can do it then. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to quickly follow up on one key priority, the three items that we haven't talked about. Number one is the Minnesota Resident Scholarship Program, the system-wide safety and security, and the final one is the American Indian Scholars Program, which is close to $80 million. That is not included in the $223.5 million. This is an important issue, and I see that it's not being prioritized in terms of how we should be able to address. If we don't provide that funding, all these programs are not going to be implemented. What is the plan within the university, and what should we be looking forward to?
Budget Director Tyler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, again, from the budget lens, if we do not get those three items, we would not, as you said, implement those programs. We would not have the bandwidth right now to do that. Now, we've talked in this committee previously about the safety and security issues. We are dealing with safety and security issues. This is the next phase, if you will, that we would like to do faster than we otherwise would be able to do. So those improvements would be delayed. On the scholarship side, right now, we do not have plans to replace those initiatives internally. If we have, because of the need to deal with inflation and fixed cost increases, we would not be able to move forward with those bold benefits for student finances in the way that we've proposed. We would not be able to do that.
Representative Norton.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Budget Director, if we don't have this funding for the scholarships, does that mean low-income students who were eligible previously will not be able to receive the funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, no, this is new. This is Everything we're doing today would be maintained. That's part of our core mission request, actually, is to help maintain the programming and services we have today. This proposal is all new additional funding that would not be available.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Budget Director, thank you so much for the clarity, because we want to increase the number of students who are able to attend the University of Minnesota, especially low-income and BIPOC students who rely on this critical resource. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Noor's question, as I did redistricting last year, I see the numbers of population shifts. And I spend a lot of time living in those numbers. We need to make sure that we have the programming in place, the development in place that's going to serve all of our students, especially those who have been most underserved. And as we look at these campuses that have excess capacity, there's no time better than the present to bring those students in and to help them succeed. So I would encourage us to really look at these commitments to our underserved students and to figure out how we broaden that service. And as I said, not everything at the university is revenue generating. Mm-hmm. And I understand that this is a very expensive proposition, but together we can figure out a way to make that happen. And I'm committed to working with you to help, and I'm sure Representative Noor and Hansen and Hicks are the same, to see what we can do to best serve all of our students and to bring them into the University of Minnesota family. Thank you.
Members, we're going to have them back on Tuesday with Budget Director Tonneson. When we go over your language, your March 1st letter was a major shift in policy to the university on its budget. So on Tuesday, when you're back, I would like built into the description of your language the rationale that the university used from going. Your first budget said it was okay to raise tuition, and you were asking, and I repeatedly said that mm-hmm. if you get your full budget request, you would be satisfied with it. Then on March 1st, there's suddenly this shift to mm-hmm. saying budget freeze, and you needed the extra money. So I'm not going to have you respond to this today, but on Tuesday, as we go through what will be your budget bill, I would like an explanation of exactly why that shift occurred from it was okay to raise tuition to freezing it, and then this added new incentive that you have to handle your problem. So we're certainly looking forward to that on Tuesday.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I will let Senior Vice President Franz know.
And I think you'll
Franz
have
know.
Fran with you to help.
Yes, I will let Senior Vice President Franz know that's your interest, and we will address that then on Tuesday.
Thank you.
Sure.
Next on the agenda is House File 1912, Representative Hansen. Representative Wolgamont, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the adoption of the minutes for this committee's meeting from March 14th, 2023.
Any discussion to the Wolgamont motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. Forgive me while I just get my documents pulled up here really quick. I was very engaged in that last discussion, so thank you for the patience. Members, House File 1912 increases the Minnesota State Grant Program. The state grant makes college both more affordable and accessible to more people, especially people who know what it's like to struggle to make ends meet. As many of you know, I'm a first-generation college graduate. I had never stepped foot on a college campus before my second college attempt when I was in my mid-20s with two young kids and a full and part-time job. I'd grown up in poverty. I'd tried and failed a semester of online college after I finished my high school as an ALC super senior with a baby, and no one in my family had ever gone to college. So I had little to no support, including financial support. When I asked my family if they would help me pay for college, they looked at me like I had three heads. There was no way that they could help me with the excessive costs that my generation and those younger than me have faced when trying to pursue a higher education that our elders, parents, and grandparents encouraged us to pursue. My path to sitting before you today was paved wholly by my access to financial aid like the Pell and Minnesota State Grant. This committee knows this, but for the sake of those watching and people who are new to this conversation, I'll just quickly explain the state grant program and its impact that this has and the changes that this bill presents. State grant program provides need-based financial aid to lower-income and middle-income Minnesota students to help them afford the cost of college. The state grant serves program serves students at public and private colleges, including students pursuing certificates, two-year degrees, and four-year degrees. It's the only part of our higher education budget that goes directly to students. The state grant program currently benefits more than 60,000 students each year, and 40% are Minnesota resident students attending colleges and universities here in our great state. Under this bill, 61,000 students would see an increase in their grants, and another 2,800 would become new recipients of the state grant. It provides an important incentive to both support families, people from families like mine, whose barriers to college was access and finances. This also helps to keep Minnesota's young people in our state, which in turn ensures we can address the dire workforce crisis that we're in. The state grant helps adult learners, many of whom have children, who are going back to college to finish their degree and to require skills to make a career change like I was. It targets lower income families with 66% of recipients making less than $50,000 a year. It also provides support for middle income families who, I'll add, also struggle to make ends meet and live paycheck to paycheck as well, with 39% of recipient families making between $50,000 and $100,000 a year. The state grant program is the state's primary tool to make the opportunity and the benefits of higher education possible for the students who've had the hardest time paying for college. This bill increases the amount of the student's grant by reducing the expected student share in the state grant formula from 50 to 42%. A study by the Office of Higher Education concluded that the student share should be lowered to 36% so that students can cover their share of college costs through reasonable work, but we're at 42% in this bill today. As a millennial, let me say very clearly that our generation and those younger than us are struggling. We're working harder than any generation before us for less money, less benefits, and with very low hopes for a secure retirement. As a reminder, millennial spending has saved this economy in this country 2 to 3 times since the 2008 recession, because when we're entering adulthood, there are so many of us, and we spend nearly all of the money that we make to meet our and our family's basic needs. Asking students to continue to pay or find funding for 50% of their total cost of attendance with today's costs is a big barrier that prevents people from enrolling in college. If we want to improve enrollment numbers and repair our workforce, we must help to cover more costs, more of the costs of college. This is an important first step in ensuring and adjusting the student share expectation to a level that's realistic for students with demonstrated financial need. Lowering student share will make college enrollment and completion more accessible to low and middle income students by making college more affordable. And Chair, I think that's our job on this committee. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Representative Hanson, before we move forward, you have an amendment I think you want to put on.
I do have an amendment. I'm so sorry for not offering that. My apologies, Chair.
And do you wish to offer it?
I would like to offer my amendment. Yes, please, Chair. The A1 amendment,
so
I
Representative
believe.
Representative Hanson has the A1 amendment. And I just think it makes a change in numbers. It isn't anything terribly significant.
So. Correct, Chair. It moves it from the previous number to the new 42% that we mentioned.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted and the bill is in order. And Representative Davids had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, you made the comment that millennials and those younger have worked harder than any other generation. Do you have any basis of fact in that? I don't see that. I don't think that's a correct statement.
Representative Haynes.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski, and thank you, Representative Davids. I'd be happy to follow up with an email about that and with statistics for you. It's important that we have this conversation in the legislature because you're right. This is not a conversation that's come up very often, and I am happy to provide more information about it.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Davids. Chair, and to the author. Many millennials and younger that I've seen don't even come close to working as hard as some of us that are, like, really old.
All right. That conversation will be followed up in an email, I guess.
Maybe
the next President Cernfenick, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Paul Cernfenick. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to begin today by thanking you, Chair Pawlowski, for hearing this bill and thanking Representative Hansen for being its chief author. This committee has placed a significant focus on declining post-secondary enrollment, which is a serious challenge for private colleges just as it is for public colleges. In your materials, we've included a graph that shows the decline in enrollment over the last 10 years for our member institutions. Since 2013, enrollment at private colleges has declined by 13% overall, with the most significant declines occurring in the last 5 years. I want to share an additional fact about declining enrollment. The largest declines in enrollment are occurring among students with the lowest incomes. Since the onset of the pandemic, across both public and private and public and nonprofit institutions of higher education, the enrollment of Pell Grant recipients declined by 14%, compared to a 7% decline among students who are not Pell Grant recipients. Pell Grant recipients, for your reference, generally come from families with incomes below $60,000. House File 1912 is a bill that addresses these enrollment declines by proposing a $120 million funding increase for the state grant program over the next biennium. Because the state grant program serves low and middle income students, a state grant funding increase will provide significant tuition relief to students who have fallen away from post-secondary education in disproportionately high numbers. As Representative Hansen said, House File 1912 proposes a reduction in the student share part of the state grant formula. The 50% student share was established in 1985, when college costs were markedly different than they are today. The student share is the only parameter of the state grant program that is arbitrary and is not based on an objective benchmark connected to the realities of paying for college. Students simply cannot cover 50% of college costs through reasonable borrowing and reasonable work hours while taking classes. An analysis by the Office of Higher Education found that for the student share to be affordable, it would need to be 36%. Lowering the student share to 42%, as proposed in the bill, would be a significant step towards meeting the affordability benchmark for low and middle income students. This investment will help more than 63,000 students because it will increase the average state grant award by $1,100 and increase the maximum state grant awards for full-time students, those with the greatest need, by between $1,850 and $2,700. Who are the students that are benefited by the state grant program? 39% of all Minnesota students going to school in Minnesota receive a state grant. 54% of Minnesota students of color receive a state grant. 74% of state grant funds go to students with family incomes below $60,000, and the remaining grant funds reach into middle-class families making between $60,000 and $120,000. Decades of research shows that a state grant increase will drive important outcomes, including increasing college enrollment, retention, and completion while reducing overall costs, holding down borrowing, decreasing the burdens of intensive work schedules, financial stress, and indebtedness, and increasing college attainment rates for low-income students and students of color and Native Americans. Thank you for your concerns for students and for the challenges facing all higher education institutions. As you consider how to best address these issues, we urge you to make a significant new investment in the Minnesota State Grant Program. An increase will make a tremendous difference to the more than 60,000 students at both public and private institutions who rely on these grants to make their college aspirations possible. Thank you. And
we have one more testifier. Yes. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Melody Herr, she, they pronouns, and I'm a junior at St. Catherine University, double majoring in political science and economics with a minor in criminal justice studies. I am here today as a fellow of the Minnesota Capital Pathways Program. This program offers paid internship opportunities to young Black Indigenous people of color to cultivate leadership in policy and government. Through this program, I was blessed to receive a position as the public affairs intern at the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Chair and members, it's programs and support like this that empower me to be here today. I'm here to ask you to support HF 1912, Increasing State Grants for Minnesota College Students. Personally, I am interested in the state grant program because it benefits our marginalized populations, including low to middle income and BIPOC graduates who attend community, technical, and private colleges. This program strives for education equity, and as a minority pursuing a college degree, this grant is very important to me. As expressed, 39% of undergraduate students receive a state grant, and this would benefit from this investment. In addition to this, 54% of undergraduate students of color and Native American students receive a state grant and would also benefit from this investment. For some context, I began my first year at St. Kate's in 2020. Less than a year before that, and right before the pandemic, my dad suffered from a heart attack where he needed immediate medical attention and surgery. Then when COVID happened, myself and two brothers lost our jobs and work hours due to quarantine. Since then, we've all been working really hard to earn these losses back. Today, I am 20 years old and I am working two jobs in addition to being a full-time student. So I do indeed believe that I am a hard worker. I am very grateful and blessed to have received scholarships and grants provided by my university because I definitely feel that without the support of this grant, I would be in a very different financial position right now. But my story is just one of many, and I strongly feel that the Minnesota State Grant has allowed me to choose the best educational option for me in terms of finances, level of rigor, and programs of my desired major. I feel very lucky to be attending St. Catherine University, an all-women's college that is overwhelmed with strong and motivated women, progressive conversations of gender inequality, and advocating for social justice in local, national, and international contexts. I know that there are many students who are just as grateful to be attending this university with the assistance of the Minnesota State Grant, and as our elected officials, we would love your support. Thank you for your time.
Questions, members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Say a question regarding Representative Knorr's. This is kind of related to Representative Hansen. Representative Knorr had a bill that would help for emergency situations for housing and fuel and food. I think that number was around 5 million. So should that be enacted into law in coalition with this bill, which will help lessen the student's responsibility? How do those two, are those two connected somehow, Mr. Chair or Representative Hansen?
I think we'll have President Cervenek. He might be the best one to respond.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I think both are needed. They complement each other. When you invest in a state grant, you're helping students afford their tuition and their normal living expenses as a college student. Students, especially at the lower income levels, have no resources to respond to an emergency, and their state grant is being applied to pay their tuition and their regular room and board. So the emergency assistance bill that Representative Knorr is authoring fills a gap that doesn't hit every student. But when they hit, they can disrupt a student so that their course of education is paused or maybe stopped entirely by a loss of a motor vehicle or a loss of some other basic resource that they need. So I think they're both needed.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you for that, and I appreciate the time we spent last week or so educating me on some of the issues. I think that I was happy to see that your amendment, Representative Hansen, went from 36 back up to 42. So I think that was a wise and prudent move on your part. But the other question then, Representative Hansen, would the grant policy, I was reading some of the material, but I don't think it's in here, apply to a trade school, a technical school? This one is 4-year and 2-year, I see in the bill, but some of the schools have only a 18-month certification program.
President Cervenek, can you answer that? Or?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. I'm going to phone a friend.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I believe the answer is yes. I'm not the perfect expert on your question, but it applies to certificates, two-year degrees, and four-year degrees. And so I believe trade schools enrollment would qualify as long as they meet the standard eligibility requirements.
We may have the answer here.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Cirkvenik is exactly correct. It applies to certificate programs, not just degree programs. So a person who's enrolled in a non-degree granting program at a technical college would be eligible for a state grant, as long as they meet all the other eligibility criteria. Right.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And then just lastly, then, was there a fiscal note on this? I don't see on lines 1.17.
President Cirkvenik.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, we don't have a fiscal note. We, when we prepared this bill, we asked the Office of Higher Education to prepare a cost estimate through their projection. They have a model. They project the cost. And the projected cost is $120.6 million for the biennium.
Representative Clemar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing the bill forward. I do think the student share is, as Mr. Cirkvenik said, too high, right? So we do need to do something about that. So as we're thinking about all of this, it will come as no surprise to the private colleges that I always say we need to think about equity across institutions as well as making sure that our students' needs are met. With that, I just want to bring some numbers to the attention of the committee as we look at this discussion about state grant and is state grant. I'm a supporter of state grant. I think it does help our families, and I'm not picking on the state grant program, but where the money goes and where it flows is really important. So when I look at, this is out of the Minnesota State Grant end of year statistics for fiscal year 2020 provided by OHE in January of 2021. On page 26 of this document, it talks about the number of recipients and then where the state grant dollars flow by millions, okay? So as I look at it, the vast majority of the students, over 61% of the students, attend public institutions, but they only receive 37% of the funds. We have 19% of the students attending nonprofit institutions, and they receive a much larger sum. They receive $71 million, and they're only 19% of the students. To Representative McDonald's statement, when I look at the list of institutions that are served by the Minnesota Private College Council, there aren't technical colleges listed. So I just want to make sure that all of our students are receiving the same. And we don't have any financial information on the actual nonprofits like we do for our state colleges and universities. So we only see posted tuition. We don't see what the real average tuition is for students. And I would like to know if we could get some of that financial information available too as we look at how we divide this.
President Cirkvenik.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Clevarne, thank you for the question. Let me start with your last question first. The average net tuition after all financial aid is taken into account, including institutional aid provided by our institutions. This last year was $14,500.
For average tuition?
The average net tuition after all aid. Secondly, I think the right comparison when you look at the dollars in the state grant program is how the dollars at the University of Minnesota system compare to our system. And what you'll see is the dollars and the size of the grants are very close. The state grant program provides aid based on the cost of attendance, which is the price of tuition and a single price for living, room and board and books expenses that's set by statutory formula. Students at four-year institutions receive larger grants because they have higher tuition prices. Also, What affects aid when you look at it by sector is whether you have full-time students or part-time students. The more part-time students you have, the smaller their total aid is at that sector or at that institution. Finally, I want to remind everyone, the grant is capped for students at private colleges at the tuition level of the University of Minnesota. So no student at a private college gets a grant that is larger than they would get if they attended the University of Minnesota. And one last point, mm-hmm. Our institutions receive no operating support that holds down the price of tuition at public institutions. I think there's, the ballpark figures are about $6,000 per student, I think, in the Minnesota state system, and over $10,000 per student at the University of Minnesota system. That is also holding down costs and price to students at public institutions that we don't benefit from. In total, our institutions receive 3% of all of the higher education investment made by the state.
Representative Klebar.
Thank you. Mr. Savenik, you just hit my hot button. I cannot believe you just said this. You've heard me go off on this before. So, to say that a nonprofit institution in this state receives no operating money from the state of Minnesota is not a factual statement. If you want to pay property tax, sales tax, and all kinds of other costs that entities that are not nonprofit pay, okay. But if you want to compare tax expenditures, I'll have that conversation with you all day long. That is state spending. It's just not in the form of cash. I'm not asking for a response from you. And I appreciate the fact that you schooled me on how state grant works. I understand fully how state grant works, and I'm not gonna go there with you. You and I both agree state grant is important. You and I both agree that we need to make sure that our students are served. But please do not sit in this committee and say that nonprofits do not receive financial support from the state. It is a partnership. You provide a benefit, we provide revenue for you in that capacity. That is my hot button. You know it's my hot button. And I'll just pass on that. But I'm going to say to you, when we have students, and we're talking about workforce grants, as Representative Hansen just said, we cannot bypass the conversation that many students who attend our two-year institutions, where their tuition is not artificially inflated, and it is capped by the state, those students receive a smaller share of state grant. That is not their fault, right? And they are pursuing their dreams. And we need to make sure that those students are equally represented in this room. And I have said in this committee, and I will repeat in this committee today, because my hot button has been pushed, that I do not understand why our private colleges, who have the mission of academics, are put in the same category as academic research and extension. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to go back to Representative Hansen's opening comments, because you said something, I'm like, wait a minute, I need to write that down. You said that the state grant program serves, did you say around 60,000 students?
Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think you said 40% of which are residents.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Let me pull up my notes to see exactly what I said, but 40% of the students at universities are Minnesota residents, and I'm going to have a call a friend to maybe say the words if I misspoke, but
okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, 40% of Minnesota resident students attending Minnesota institutions receive a state grant.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. That helps clarify, because the way I heard it was that only 40% of the recipients were Minnesota residents. I'm like, I thought this program is for Minnesota residents. So I wanted to clarify that. And I just wanted to say, and I know there's a little kerfuffle here going back between Representative Davids and the bill's author, but, you know, Representative Hansen, you know, you talked about working a full and a part-time job during college. And I think that millennials and Gen Xers and whatever Gen Zers, I've kind of lost track of where the dividing lines and what the names for everybody is. But I think that it's a good example to show the lack of fragility that you have. So many of these folks think they're fragile and they can't do stuff on their own, and you did stuff on your own. And so I give you credit for that.
Representative Polder.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this conversation's taken a little bit of a turn from where I originally started. So just a brief question here, and I'm not sure if this is for Representative Hansen, the testifiers, or potentially nonpartisan staff. But the assigned student responsibility is currently 50%. And am I correct in understanding? So that includes tuition and then the, I'm not going to get the abbreviation, the LL and ME, the living and miscellaneous. Okay, I had to like process that for a moment. Can you just remind me quickly, what is the breakdown of that within that 50%? How much of that is tuition? How much of that is living miscellaneous expenses?
President Cervenek, you want to respond to that?
The living and miscellaneous expense amount is established in the statute. I don't have the exact figure, but it's about $13,000. And the tuition depends on the institution a student is at. It's capped at the highest two-year and four-year public institutions. So a student's total of cost of attendance is the addition of their tuition plus the living and miscellaneous expense amount, about $13,000.
Representative Fulton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to clarify then, the living miscellaneous expenses, whatever the number is, that is a dollar figure rather than a percentage. Am I correct in understanding that?
President Cervenek.
Could you repeat that question again? I'm not sure I tracked it.
My question was, so the assigned student responsibility consists of tuition and living and miscellaneous expenses, and that living and miscellaneous expenses piece, that is a dollar figure rather than a
correct. It's not a percent of tuition. It's a dollar figure established in the statute. It's tied to the federal poverty level, and it increases when the inflation adjustment is made to the federal poverty level.
Okay, thank you. That's extremely helpful. I just wanted to clarify that. So sort of taking a step back here, I again just want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this bill forward. I thought it was a very striking comment that you referred to this correctly as the only direct aid to students attending post-secondary institutions. And I think that's a piece that we do need to keep in mind as we continue budget discussions, that this is funding that goes directly to students attending college. Though I will say that as a St. Olaf alum, submitting a letter from Gus Davis was not the best way to win my support. But thank you.
All right, Representative Hansen, one last word, and then we're going to go to the next bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, and thank you to all my co-authors that are on this committee from both sides of the table. I really appreciate everyone's support on this. And I just have to say, as a Katie, I'm happy to have a Katie here with me, too. So, you know, I did bring my team, and I hope you bring yours next time, too. So thank you, everybody, and thank you, Chair, for your support and the committee.
Next bill on the agenda, House File 863, Representative Wogemann. Representative Wogemann, I think you have an amendment to.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
So why don't you move your amendment and then tell us what it does?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to start off by moving the adoption of the A1 amendment. It is pretty simple. It takes the numbers from the fiscal note and puts them into the blank appropriation spots that are in the bill. I will be happy in my presentation to explain those numbers in the broader context of the bill.
So to the amendment, I don't see any discussion. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the form the author wishes. Representative Wilmer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 863. As all of you know, our law enforcement agencies are experiencing dire workforce shortages. It's happening in my community in St. Cloud, and it's happening here in the Twin Cities, and it's happening through every community in our state. And this workforce shortage in law enforcement places a direct threat to the safety and security of our communities. So it's incumbent upon us to use every tool at our disposal to attract more people into the law enforcement profession. That's why I'm bringing forward House File 863, which is a bill to establish a time-limited tuition relief grant program for students pursuing an associate degree in law enforcement to incentivize more individuals to become peace and police officers. Mr. Chair and members, here's how the bill works. To be eligible, a student must be considered a Minnesota resident and be enrolled in a professional peace officer education program by September 1st, 2028. Students must also complete the FAFSA and apply for state and federal grants. Students must make satisfactory academic progress, and they can only receive a grant for a maximum of 4 semesters. Grants must be paid back and deposited into the general fund if any recipient does not complete a police officer program by June 30th of 2031. And grants must also be paid back if a student completes a program but does not become a police officer. Want to give you a sense, Mr. Chair and members, of the numbers that this would affect. You can see on page 4 of the fiscal note, in the fall of 2021, there were 883 Minnesota resident students enrolled in eligible law enforcement programs. Of those students, 633 submitted a FAFSA and would meet the eligibility requirements for the program that we would be creating in House File 863. So based on the estimated need of the 633 students, 271 would qualify for an award in fiscal year 2024 with an average annual award of $2,798, and in fiscal year 2025, 221 students would qualify for an award with an average annual award of $3,831. Mr. Chair and members, that's how we get to the appropriation that was put onto the bill through the adoption of the A1 amendment. It would be $960,000 in fiscal year 2024, $954,000 in fiscal year 2025, and then $923,000 going forward in ongoing through 2031. I would also like to draw the attention to members of a letter that is in your packets that was submitted by the Minnesota Peace and Police Officers Association, sharing their wholehearted support for House File 863, as it will enhance the recruitment of new public safety officers into the law enforcement profession. That is the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'd be more than happy to take any questions that you or members of the committee may have.
Questions from the committee? Or Representative
Dave. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the author for bringing House File 863 as amended. I don't like using the word crisis because we use it too often, but if there is a crisis, this would be one of them, and this bill starts to address that. So thank you very much, and I'm hoping we see this in a bigger bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wogelmont, did I hear you right? This would pay for the total amount of tuition and fees. And did you say that that was around $2,000-some-odd annually, or is that per semester?
Representative Wogelmont.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. I would draw your attention to page 4 of the fiscal note, if you have that. Towards the middle there, it says that based on the estimated remaining need of the 633 students, which is calculated by tuition and fees minus Pell Grant, state grant, and the average institutional grant, 271 students will qualify for an award in fiscal year 2024 with an average annual award of $2,798. And then in fiscal year 2025, 221 students would qualify for an award with an average annual award of $3,831.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you happen to know, I mean, that means that all these other things could be layered on top of that award. So do you know the average cost of tuition at one of these institutions for law enforcement?
Representative Boldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not have that number in front of me, but maybe someone from the Office of Higher Education or our fiscal staff could fill in that number.
Representative Morgan, we're in possession of the bill too, and we can get that as we move.
Yeah, I'm curious how far, you know, that'll go and how much, what a percentage of the total tuition that would cover.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Wolgamott. I just wanted to remind us that last year we had a similar bill before us that we talked about, and in that conversation we talked about the importance of an interdisciplinary approach to making sure that we can address the needs that are happening within our communities, that, you know, a holistic public safety approach isn't just you know, making sure that there's just more police. They need our support in making sure we can help with some of the ancillary things that they deal with, whether it be mental health crises, domestic violence cases, whatever that may be. So I don't know about most people, but I've heard over and over in my community, at least, that our officers are asking us to make some equitable investments in social workers as well, so that we can continue to have social workers at some of these really, really intense mental health crisis events, because it is a crisis, and I do think that that is the right place to use this word. We've heard it state wide. And so I just want to go on record as saying I still support that. I still think that's important. I have a number of bills that are in this committee's possession to do that as well. And so as we go forward, to the folks that have asked me to add this, this is me kind of fulfilling their request on that. So thank you, Vice Chair Wolgamott.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. I cannot agree with you more. There are many things that we need to do as a legislature to support our law enforcement and support our communities and enhance public safety. This bill certainly is not the one, you know, magical solution that is going to solve all of those, but is one way that we as a committee, as a legislature, is one tool that I'm hoping we can use to incentivize more people into the law enforcement profession. But I absolutely agree with you and would be eager to work with you on those efforts to bring a holistic approach to supporting our law enforcement, to enhancing the law enforcement profession, of course, with the ultimate goal of keeping our community safe, of keeping our peace and police officers safe. And yeah, I would look forward to working with you on those other bills. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I will keep this very short. Representative Wolgamott, I know there's a couple schools, Alexandria Tech is one of them, and Wilmer had that offer schools training and schools for law enforcement. Do you have a list of other schools in the metro area or throughout the state? Just curious of the number of schools that offer this program for a law degree. And I do have the number if you wanted to know what it cost, but for tuition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. I do not have such a list on hand at the moment, but I would be happy to get that to you while this bill remains in the possession of this committee.
I think we may have it.
Mr. Chair, I have the list of approved post-board programs. Would you like me to read the institutions, or I can also forward it to the committee members? Okay, so the post-board approved programs, degree granting programs, are at Alexandria Technical Community College, Bemidji State University, Central Lakes College, Century College, Concordia University in St. Paul, Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, Hamline University, Hennepin Technical College, Inverhills Community College, Leech Lake Tribal College, Metropolitan State University, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Minnesota North College, both the Hibbing and Vermilion campuses, Minnesota State Community and Technical College, Minnesota State University Moorhead, Minnesota West Community and Technical College, Northland Community and Technical College, Rasmussen University, Ridgewater College, Riverland Community College, Rochester Community and Technical College, Southwest Minnesota State University, St. Cloud State University, St. Mary's University, University of Minnesota Crookston, University of Northwestern in St. Paul, University of St. Thomas, and Winona State University.
Representative, I hope you wrote all those down.
Mr. Chair, I'd also be happy to forward this to them.
Just forward it to us. All right, last word, Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for your consideration of House File 863. Now is the time to invest in the next generation of peace and police officers. Now is the time to fund education opportunities for law enforcement. Let's include House File 863 in our final finance omnibus bill. Let's ensure that our local police chiefs and sheriffs have the workforce they need to keep our communities safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, next week we're going to go over some bill language, so I would hope we would have a good attendance, and we are going to be revisiting again the University of Minnesota and the discussion on their budget. And with that, meeting is adjourned.